Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and tonight I'm joined by my co-hosts, Sam and Crystal. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Tonight, our guest is Tracy A. Wilkinson to discuss contraception counseling for adolescents. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us about what this podcast is all about?
Ah, yes, absolutely. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Wilkinson. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics and is associated with the Department of OBGYN at Indiana University. Her clinical and research interest centers on examining and developing interventions to improve young people's access to reproductive health services from the perspective of a general pediatrician. Today, she teaches us about centering our patients in conversations about contraception. Of note, Indiana University has received funding on behalf of Dr. Wilkinson for research from Organon, Bayer, and Cooper Surgical. All efforts have been made to discuss and present balanced information about all treatment options.
Excellent. Time to ring in our main discussion.
I get it.
Or we can implant some knowledge about contraception.
Nice.
Time to inject some wisdom into our conversation.
I get it. I don't know if I love it, but I get it.
Let's not be contraceptive about sharing knowledge.
Oh, now there we go.
There we go. All right. Dr. Wilkinson, thanks for coming on the show. Because we're an informal group, is it okay if I call you by your first name?
Absolutely. Please call me Tracy.
Excellent. Excellent. So we have a huge episode for everyone tonight. But first, I would like you to introduce yourself for our listening audience who doesn't know you.
Yeah. So my name's Tracy Wilkinson. I am a general pediatrician and a health services researcher. And I focus all of my work, research, advocacy around reproductive health care access for adolescents and young adults. So I'm so excited to talk to you guys today.
We're really excited. And we're talking before the show that I feel like this is going to really help me fill a lot of the gaps of my knowledge. So super excited.
Yeah. And we actually have we have so much to talk about. So much content here that we're just going to go right into it. We're going to kind of skip all the intro questions. If anyone does have questions about your intro, please check out another episode. Please email. Please do all of those types of things. And then Crystal can jump into the case.
Fall always feels like a reset. Between busier schedules and shorter days, finding the time to cook can be really tough. That's why I use Factor. Factor makes it easy to eat well without the stress of meal prep. Their meals are chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. For me, that's huge. I often don't have much time in the hospital, and Factor lets me skip the chopping, cooking, and cleanup while still eating something satisfying. I also love their vegetarian meals, especially the pastas. They're comforting, filling, honestly some of my go-tos when I need something fast but delicious. Factor also gives you more variety each week, from Mediterranean diet meals to GLP-1-friendly options and even premium seafood like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. And now you can try new bold global flavors too. No matter your routine, you'll find something that works. And with Factor, you can save time, eat well, and actually look forward to your meals, even on the busiest days. So here's the deal. Eat smart at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase.
I'm excited to go into our outpatient clinic where it's also equally as busy. And you are seeing Chioma for the well child visit. Chioma is a 16-year-old who's assigned female at birth and identifies as a girl who has a history of intermittent headaches and asthma. You've asked her parents to step out into the waiting room so you can talk to Chioma independently. After reviewing confidentiality, you ask Chioma if she has anything that she would like to discuss, and she asks you about birth control. So our first question to open up this conversation is, why is it important to talk about contraception or birth control with adolescents and young adults?
So I think it's so important to offer every single patient the opportunity to ask you questions about contraception or birth control. First of all, it opens the door and lets them know that you are a trusted adult that they can talk to you about questions that they might have. But second of all, we should never assume that our young people are getting information from any other source that is evidence-based or, you know, valid information. A lot of young people are not receiving sex education from school. There's certainly lots of states that minimize sex education to only abstinence only or do not provide evidence-based sex education. And so every opportunity you have a young person in a situation where you can offer them that information is a win-win, in my opinion.
And before we get into the nuances of counseling, is there any additional history that you need from Chioma? Sometimes I've heard when I was a medical student that some people wanted a pelvic exam or a urine pregnancy test. Are there any major things before we get into the nuances of counseling that you would recommend?
Yeah. So I do want to clarify, you don't need any of those things to just talk about birth control. Talking about birth control does not lead to any changes in behavior, and a lot of evidence supports that. But what is really important is to try and open up the space to have this conversation well before birth control is even needed, right? And so I don't want anyone to think that you should wait until somebody is sexually active to have this conversation. Quite the opposite. You should be having this open space and this open ability to ask questions long before a patient is interested in using birth control.
So I guess my question is, when you say long before, like, what would you say would be an appropriate age to start having this discussion? Like, obviously, it may depend on, you know, as you developed a rapport with the patient and the family and, you know, what their thoughts are. But what would you say would be an ideal age, and what are you looking for when you think it's an appropriate time?
Yeah, I get this question a lot. And one of the things I try to tell people is that there is no one age that applies to all patients. So, you know, I think it's really important to have a confidential part of your exam with almost any patient that can talk to you on their own. So I do not restrict my confidential portions of exams only to teenagers. As soon as a kid is independent enough to answer questions with me without their parent, what I'm really trying to do is teach them some autonomy and having some independence while they're at a clinician's office well before they're a teenager. There are lots of things you want to talk about with kids that their answers would be different if the parents were in the room. Like, how is school going? How are things going at home? You know, are you feeling hungry ever? Or do you guys have enough food to eat? Do you have a place to live? And so there are a lot of things besides sex that you want to talk about. And so I usually encourage people to just normalize that moment of confidential visit time with every patient that they think that they can do that with. It also decreases the anxiety parents have. If this is just something that happens during every visit, just for a few minutes, then it's not a big deal when they get closer and closer to their age of sexual debut.
Perfect. And I think this takes us back to our patient, Chioma, who shares with you that she's sexually active with one male partner. She has vaginal and oral sex and uses condoms about 50% of the time. Her menses are normal. She has some headaches, but no history of migraines. She doesn't smoke or vape or think anyone in her family has any other medical problems that should be aware of. She's never been on birth control before. So I think the big question that we all have on our minds is, what is your approach to counseling this patient about birth control options?
Yeah. So I usually start with asking the patient what they know about birth control and what are some of the methods that they've heard about. And is there a method that they want me to talk to them about first? Because a lot of them do have an answer to that question, and it's helpful to start with what the patient wants to lead with rather than starting with what you want to lead with. And this is a great opportunity, Christelle, to talk about what values patients have when they're choosing a birth control method might be different than the values we have as clinicians. Most doctors are going to pick the most effective medication for something, right? Like, if you have high blood pressure, you want to pick the medicine that works the best. But birth control, I always say the best method for a patient is the one that they want to use. And that is not specifically the method that works the best in, like, you know, randomized control trials. And so when we lead with things that matter to us, we miss this important moment to hear from the patient what matters to them. So, some other things to consider. about methods is, you know, does it have an impact on their periods? Is it something that they can start or stop on their own? Is it something that their partner can feel? Is it something that might affect their sex drive? Is it something that might affect their fertility? And so those are all important aspects that you want to get at instead of only how good does that birth control method work.
I like how, you know, you're trying to find the patient where they're at and try to meet them there. I guess one question I have is, are there common myths or misconceptions that you run across that you hear often? And what is your type of answers to those most common misconceptions that you hear?
There are so many misperceptions and misinformation about birth control. And I think that that's accentuating in the world that we live in and the world of social media. And I can sidebar talk about the politics behind that. But I think it's really important to let your patient explain what they've heard and not to diminish or minimize the experience that they're describing. Because if their message about, for example, let's say Depo, Provera, which is an injection, a progestin injection that you get once every 3 months, and their sister got it and gained a lot of weight, and they come to you and they say, I don't want to get Depo because I don't want to gain a lot of weight. It's really important for you to pause and say, I can understand why you feel that way. Nobody would want a method that would cause them to gain weight if that was not intended to happen. What I often see happening is clinicians dismissing that and going to the data and saying, well, you know, the data doesn't really show that that causes weight gain. And that is not listening to your patient and having them look at you as somebody that's trusting what they're saying and believing what they're saying. Because what happened to her sister is much more important than what the data shows. She is trying to express to you what really matters. And so it's really important as a clinician to be listening.
And I think off of that point, what I've experienced in my own clinical practice is that patients will, yeah, trust you a lot more when you're listening to them. And then when we're thinking about how adolescents and young people make decisions around birth control, what they hear from friends and family and those experiences really does matter on how they make their decisions. And so I love that, you know, you're taking in what the patient has to say. And I think that also gives us an equity perspective too, right? We're meeting every patient where they are. And before we maybe get into some of the conversations about the medications, any comments about disparities in access or thinking broader about questions of equity and how do we meet our patients where they are and give them what they need?
Yeah, Crystal, this is a great point because there is actually a lot of data and evidence around reproductive coercion based on race and ethnicity of patients. And we as clinicians are responsible for that, right? Like when we see big data showing disparities or, you know, differential use or patients reporting that they're being counseled differently based on the color of their skin, we have to be listening to that and we have to be changing our behavior. And so it's really, really important that we center our birth control conversations with our patients as to what matters to them and what they've experienced and what they're looking for, and not the big data and not the big evidence, but what is the person in front of you.
And I think we've been talking a lot about how we're going to counsel these patients, but we don't know with what evidence or how these things work yet and all those types of things. I think I really want to circle back around once we talk about these pills or patches or injectables or whatever they may be, once we talk about them, to then go back to that conversation again and say, okay, now how are you using this with the things that we learned? So with that in mind, let's kind of start with wherever you would like to start. We can kind of guide us through all the options as we go. But let's say, hey, let's start off the bat. What's the easiest thing that you want to talk about first? Say you're talking to one of your patients and you're bringing it up for the first time. What do you generally start with when it comes to contraception options?
Yeah. So what I generally say is, like, I'm going to list a couple of categories and I want you to tell me what might resonate with you as to something that matters. Do you want to talk about things in reference to how they affect your periods or not? Do you want to talk about things in reference to whether you can start or stop them on your own, whether they require a procedure or not, or whether they affect your ability to get pregnant in the near future? And so I'll list things like that. again, oftentimes, if you start also with the patient saying, is there any method that you want to talk about first that you've heard about that you want to start this conversation with? That's also a good starting point there. But I try to also frame things on the values that the patients have. If a patient says, I absolutely do not want a procedure, I do not want something that's inside my body, we should not be spending time counseling them on intrauterine devices and arm implants. That is not listening to a patient and instead wasting your time.
Yeah. And that's a good point, because as we kind of talked about earlier, that you only have 15, 20 minutes and we have so many options. So we got to go somewhere. So let me just start and just say, you know what? I hate my period. I would love something that affects my period. Can you help me with that?
Yeah. So I would say there are lots of methods that we can use to help your periods get better. The methods that help your periods get lighter and easier tend to be methods that contain estrogen. And so the methods that contain estrogen that we can talk about are the most common forms of the birth control pill, the patch that you wear on your skin, the vaginal ring that goes into your vagina.
So most people have heard of the pill, or what we call the pill, or combined contraceptives that include estrogen. Can you kind of walk us through the medicines that are in there, how it works, and what you would tell the families, just the patient, if we're not necessarily talking to the parents right now?
Oh, that's a great question, Sam. So I often will start a conversation to be like, do you want to involve your parents in this conversation? A lot of young people have great support with their parents and make these decisions with their parents. And so I try to encourage a trusted adult in everybody's life, multiple trusted adults if they can. Sometimes that's not their parent and that's okay, but I certainly want to make sure that people listening to this podcast don't exclude parents when the patient is interested in the parent being involved.
Awesome. Awesome.
So what I normally say to patients, whoever's listening, parents, whoever's in the room, is that, you know, these methods have two types of hormones that your body makes. And what they do to prevent pregnancy is that they prevent ovulation, which is when your body releases an egg. So the way you don't get pregnant is that there's no egg around to be made into a pregnancy. It also works by thinning the lining of your uterus, which is why your periods get lighter.
Awesome. That seems like a great place to start. I love that. You know, sounds like I want that right now. You know, so can you kind of talk about then how that works? How do we do it?
Yeah. So the three methods that we talked about, the pill, the patch, and the ring, really work differently in respect to how often you have to take them. So the birth control pill is something that you take every day. The birth control patch is a sticker that you wear on your body all the time, but you change it once a week. And then the vaginal ring can either be a monthly ring, so you change it every month, but there are also vaginal rings that last longer than that. And so I'll just leave it at that.
And so just kind of talking about now the nuances. So we had, okay, I could take a pill, I can put a patch on, or I can put something in my vagina. So now we say, all right, well, how easy is that? You know, so how do we take the pill? What happens if we miss a pill? How, you know, how often do I need to get it? How easy is that component? And same thing that goes to the patch. Like, what if it falls off? What, is it easy to shower with? Is it, you know, all those types of questions.
Yeah. So I always send patients home with a handout on the method that they're getting. That has all that kind of information, Sam, because you can tell people that, but they're not going to remember 3 months from now when they forget a pill, like what they're supposed to do. Yeah. And then I talk about we can do two ways to start it. We could start it today, or we can wait until your next period. And I talk through what the two options are for that. We recommend quick starting any method, and most methods can be started like on the day that you receive them. And so based on where she is in her cycle, when she had last unprotected sex, you can then kind of counsel through that. And we can include in the show notes some of the favorite resources I have on like a quick start algorithm.
I actually would like to just talk about that for a second, because I actually think that is a really important point for us as doctors to know off the bat. Not necessarily about, okay, when you start the pill within the middle of your cycle, but let's definitely talk about it in the sense of when was your last unprotected sex, because I think that's a really important concept to talk about.
The quick start algorithm really depends on whether you are like less than 7 days from your last period or more than 7 days from your last period. If you're less than 7 days from your last period, you can go ahead and start a method today. You're still within that pre-ovulation window, and so the method can go ahead and start working. If you're greater than 7 days, then you want to ask, have you had unprotected sex, which means no protection from like a condom? And this patient, for example, uses condoms 50% of the time, so you'd want to kind of tease that out a little bit. Then you can talk about doing a pregnancy test if there was unprotected sex to rule out a pregnancy. And then if there hasn't been unprotected sex, then you can go ahead and start the method with a backup method for the next 7 days. So the other thing I tell patients is like all of these methods can be used to also skip your periods. So I like to talk to them about that because that's also a benefit around using birth control. You have a soccer tournament coming up, you have prom coming up, and you don't want to have your period over that time. Well, let's talk about how to use your birth control to skip a period. It's safe and easy to do if they know how to do it. The second thing I talk about is that this is protecting you from pregnancy, but it is not protecting you from sexually transmitted infections. And so I really would want to tease out from this patient in particular, tell me what happens the times you're not using a condom. Is it because you guys don't have it? Is it because you're in a certain location and it's harder for you guys to, you know, have condoms at your house versus his house? Is it because you guys are just so in the moment that you don't put a condom on? Or is it because your partner is asking you not to use a condom? These are all different things we can intervene on. But until you start asking some of those questions, you're not going to have the right advice on how to navigate that for them.
And then I think maybe just so I'm doing a little bit of teach back, just make sure I'm getting it. So it sounds like for maybe if a patient's coming in, they probably, let's say like they're thinking about their periods, or maybe they're just kind of open to conversation. The options that have two different types of hormones, that estrogen and that progesterone, are going to be the pill, the patch, and the vaginal ring. And the things that are going to help me as their pediatrician, as their clinician, is going to be to tease out how frequently do they want to use this method. So the pill sounds like that's an everyday thing versus the patch, which is more of on a weekly basis, versus the vaginal ring, which we talked about, has some different options as far as how frequently you're going to have to interact with that method. And then when it comes to managing things like periods, all three of them can actually be really helpful in managing periods for folks as well too. And then we can think about the quick start method as an opportunity to really increase access for people to start them right there, making sure that we ask questions about when their last menses was, and also making sure that we ask about their last unprotected sex.
Yeah, that was perfect. And then the last thing I always tell patients is that, you know, no method of birth control is your forever method. So let's try this. And I want you to call our office or come back if there is something about this method that you don't like. And I usually either schedule an appointment or have a phone call with them about 6 weeks after an appointment to just touch base and see how things are going. I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that the first time somebody's using birth control is going to be a new experience for them, and to provide that kind of wraparound care for them. I also want to say that for any birth control method, there's two things that we should be doing. We should be providing a year's worth prescription. So depending on what state you live in, some states, for example, provide coverage for 12 months dispensing, while other states you need to like send 3 months at a time, but with 4 refills. But that gives you a solid year worth of birth control. And the evidence shows that when you give a whole year supply, the ability of a patient to continue taking that medication for the whole year is much improved, because there's no need for them to keep calling back and getting refills. The second thing I always tell people is that for whatever method we're talking about, we're also going to talk about emergency contraception, because that is another form of birth control. It's a backup form of birth control if you've chosen another form of birth control as your plan A. But we need to talk about emergency contraception as well for that uh-oh moment, or if they decided to stop the birth control method and they're not using anything a month or two from now.
We're definitely going to talk about emergency contraception. We couldn't complete this episode without it. So I'm actually going to table that before we kind of get going. And we're going to hit up on another thing. I actually have two more questions to ask about these concepts of estrogen-containing medicines. First one, are there any other benefits that we should know about? We kind of talked about decreased periods. We talked about controlling your periods. We talked about having all these kind of choices. Are there any other benefits we need to know about? Because then I'm going to ask about drawbacks and contraindications and concerns about estrogen.
I'm wondering if like another benefit is like a quick return to fertility. Do you guys think that's a benefit?
That's fantastic. I mean, we will leave it. We can probably leave it at that too, just to say, look, this is kind of that piece. Granted, we're talking about, you know, 16-year-olds and under, and you know, whether people feel very different about when they want to have babies, but we like to think that maybe they should be a little bit older nevertheless. And so I know just saying the fertility piece, but we probably don't have to like talk all about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of the misinformation out there about birth control is that it can impact your fertility. And so hearing that from us, that like when you decide to stop this medication, you can get pregnant the next month if you so choose. And, you know, as your clinician, I am supportive of if and when you decide to become a parent.
Awesome. And so the drawbacks about estrogen, though, what do you think we should know about? What are the contraindications? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So one of the things I try to remind people of is that, you know, a lot of the misinformation and scariness about birth control is tied to estrogen, but the levels of estrogen you have in your body when you're pregnant are to the 10th degree. And so while there are things to consider with estrogen, a pregnancy can be much more dangerous and much more harmful to somebody's health than birth control. And so just level setting that to get started. You know, it can cause breast tenderness. It can cause some, you know, nausea or bloating feeling, especially when people first start taking it. So sometimes I tell families, or sorry, sometimes I tell patients that if those are some of your side effects, taking it in the evening might help so that you kind of sleep through some of those side effects instead of in the morning. But in general, you know, the two big contraindications I really worry about in young people are high blood pressure and a history of migraines with auras. A history of migraines alone is not a reason to not use estrogen, but it is really important to make sure you're ruling out that there's no aura associated with those migraines, because that is a contraindication to using estrogen. And so it's an important piece I always document in my note that I have asked and verified, so that that is, you know, in my note somewhere as the contraindication has been cleared.
And can you explain why a little bit about what we care about?
Yeah, it, you know, in specific, so I'm going to, how do I say that? I'm trying to not get into the CDC mech, but maybe I will. So the Centers for Disease Control has a medical eligibility criteria chart that I highly recommend. They also have an app on your phone where you can put in a person's age, whether they have any of the contraindications, whether they're a smoker, whether they have high blood pressure, and then it'll tell you all the methods that you are eligible for. But one of the things that's important to note is that if you have a history of migraines with aura, it puts you at an increased risk of blood clots and strokes. And that is never something that you want to have happen to a patient that has started birth control or is using birth control.
Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from that documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. And start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe.
So I probably have my final question, unless anyone else wants to jump in about this kind of section. Prescribing this. So what are we actually prescribing? What medicine do I prescribe physically? Like, what is the pack of bird? What's the patch order? Like, it's 22 micrograms of estrogen something, or, you know, walk me through, actually the medicine that I'm prescribing so we know.
So what I normally tell people to have for a pill is to have like a lower estrogen pill that you know is on like your Medicaid formulary, and then a higher estrogen birth control pill. The reason is that I always start with the low estrogen pill. And if the patient is having breakthrough bleeding, then I will bump up to the higher estrogen pill. But I try to start with the low one so that we can get away with as little estrogen and as little side effects from that estrogen as possible to start.
And does that come in the same way in the patch, or is the patch only one, if you just type it in, it's just one dose?
Yeah, the patch is only one dose. And there are generic versions of that. And the same with the vaginal ring. There are different vaginal rings based on like how often you change it. And there's even one called Annovera where you use the same ring for the whole year. And so you, you know, take it out to have your period every month, but then you use it again the next month.
So we just had a great conversation. Chioma's very interested in some of the methods, but then we learned that she has actually a contraindication to estrogen and is just kind of interested in whatever options are out there for her.
Yeah, so I would reassure her that there are other options out there and that these forms of birth control just have one hormone in it, which is progestin. The way these medications work primarily is by thickening the cervical mucus. And so that kind of mucus blocks the sperm and the egg from ever meeting. And so that's how these medications primarily work. The options for those include what we call the mini pill, as well as injectable contraception, as well as the subdermal implant or an intrauterine device.
Let's say she's not interested in doing anything that involves any type of procedures. What kind of things does she have left?
Yeah, so she has what we call the mini pill and the injectable contraception, which we inject every 3 months. To note, the injectable contraception can be injected IM, which is intramuscular, in clinic, but there's also a subcutaneous form that you can teach patients to inject on their own every 3 months at home. So the progestin-only pill is also available via prescription, but it has recently become available over-the-counter. It is over-the-counter by a name brand called the O-Pill, and it is a progestin-only pill that you take every day to prevent pregnancy, similar to the combined pill that we talked about earlier.
Perfect. So let's talk about the pieces of the puzzle there. So like, what are the benefits of taking this medicine? And then unfortunately, we would do it more often unless there was downsides. So what are the downsides as well?
Yeah. So, you know, similar to the birth control pill, you know, you can skip periods. It can lower the flow of your period, and it also has a quick return to fertility.
And what about the downsides? Why are we talking so much about what we call OCPs, oral combined contraceptives, first, not this one off the bat? Is it harder to take?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam. So the progestin-only pill does have a reputation of not being a pill that is very forgiving if you are late to taking a dose or if you miss a dose. I do want to add that, you know, the over-the-counter, a lot of that data comes from large data where people were taking both combined and progestin-only pills. And so some of the data that was required for the over-the-pill application for the O-pill actually showed that there's a little bit more wiggle room there with the O-pill if you are late to taking a dose or if you have missed a dose than I think even some of us as clinicians were taught or give it credit for.
So how might you counsel a patient who around like the timing of their birth control pills, whether it is the progesterone-only pill or that OCP? What is the counseling that you're giving them?
Yeah, so I always say that starting a new habit is really hard. And so tying it to another habit that you have is always helpful, whether that is brushing your teeth in the morning or the evening, or taking, you know, your dog out for a walk, or when you get home from school, like something that you do every single day. There are lots of reminders on phones that can work. There are apps that will remind you. And so kind of working with the patient to think through what would be the helpful way for them to remember is an important way for them to think about how to implement starting to take a new medication. I think taking a medication every day is incredibly hard, and I'm really honest with patients about that so that they feel like if they are late or if they miss a dose, that that's normal and that's okay, and they're not doing anything bad. I mean, full disclosure, my kids are put on antibiotics, and they maybe get 75% of the doses because I, as a pediatrician, still can't do it. And so I talk to them about like, okay, but what happens if you miss a pill, or what is that going to do to the efficacy of your birth control as an important element, and talking about what does it mean to have a backup method until your birth control method is back up to working as good as it can.
Awesome. And then from a starting perspective, when we talk about quick starts for this pill, is it similar in the sense that you always do ovulate at roughly the same part of the menstrual cycle, or is it have something to do that's different because it's progestin only?
Yeah, great question. So you can start it similar to the way you do a combined contraceptive pill, where you can quick start it on the same day, and you really need to figure out how far away they are from their period, as well as whether they've had unprotected sex if you're greater than 7 days out from your period.
Maybe going into the injectable contraception, what are some conversations that you have around the menstrual cycle when it comes to recommending this method?
Yeah, great question, Crystal. So the injectable contraception is contraception that we give you once every 3 months. And one of the benefits that some people feel to this medication is that it actually lightens your period, and for some people can make your period go all the way away. And if a patient tells you that having their period every single month is really important for them because it just lets them know that they're not pregnant, I do not recommend this contraceptive method because I can't promise them that they're going to have their menstrual cycle every single month on this method. The other thing that's important to say is that once you have an injection, you have that medication in your body for the next 3 months, and you can't like stop using it if you change your mind, because it's going to continue to start working. So unlike something like the birth control pill or the patch or the ring, where you can just like stop using it altogether, the injection is, you know, in your system and working for the next 3 months. We can't undo that. So again, something really important for us to talk about with patients so that they feel comfortable with the decision and understand kind of the limits to using this medication.
So one question I have is that, you know, every 3 months, sometimes it's not perfect, right? There's holidays that happen, there's school, there's vacations. What if someone just missed an appointment, or, you know, they're due for the 3 month follow-up and they miss it, they blow past it by a week or 2 or 3 weeks. How do we manage that?
If you are more than 15 weeks from your last injection, then we say that your method is potentially not going to continue to be effective, and we need to redo a pregnancy test or make sure that you have not had unprotected sex before we give you another injection.
And so let's talk about actually that component, right? About how to actually start this medicine, when you last had unprotected sex, what your urine pregnancy test can and can't do. Would you mind kind of walking through the initiation for this?
So similar to the other methods that we talked about, you want to ask where they are in their menstrual cycle, so when their last menstrual period was, and whether or not they are 5 days.
It would be 7 days is your cutoff for like your menstrual cycle. If they are less than 7 days, then you're good to go. If they're more than 7 days, then you're thinking about unprotected sex or not.
Yes.
And then if they have had unprotected sex, we get the pregnancy test. And then if they want to start it now versus later, then I think it's like 5 days to think about like whether or not your pregnancy test would capture the information that you're
right.
You're open for. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Perfect. Excellent teach-back moment. Covering what we talked about earlier in the episode, Crystal. Wonderful. And then kind of similar on the same lines as the previous questions, right? We're kind of going through each of these methods in a slightly different manner, but still the same concepts across the board. Any other drawbacks, anything else that we should know for the injectable contraception?
Yeah. So one thing I also talk about for the injectable contraception is that there can be a delay to return to fertility with an injectable contraception that can last for a few months after you stop using it. For most young people, there is no delay to return to fertility. But again, this is something that we can't always predict. And so if somebody is close to trying to become pregnant or actively thinking about becoming a parent sometime soon, you'll want to have a conversation with them about this so that they don't feel that they were misled and it was hard for them to get pregnant and nobody told them that that was a side effect of this medicine that they were on.
what are the other options? You know, they heard about everything we had so far, but they want to know about these implants or these other procedural birth control options. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, the other two methods are progestin only that include procedures such as the contraceptive arm implant, the subdermal implant, or the intrauterine device. So they both work similarly as all the other progestin methods, where they're preventing pregnancy primarily by thickening cervical mucus. And, you know, they last for different periods of time. So the contraceptive implant is placed really simply during an office procedure. It takes more time to set up the office procedure than it does to actually place the subdermal implant. I usually walk them through what that would look like in case they're interested. But then I tell them that, you know, it can last anywhere from 3 years, which is what's on the label, all the way up to 5 years, which is what some evidence is showing that it is effective up to 5 years. Intrauterine devices, there are lots of different types of those. There are hormonal and non-hormonal types of intrauterine devices. They do require to be placed, you know, a pelvic exam, and they can last anywhere from 3 years all the way up to 12 years. And then I always tell patients that just because they last that long does not mean that you have to use them for that long. And it's very important that if you decide to stop using a method, that the provider that you are working with or that placed it listens to you and takes it out.
Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge about core topics in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a pediatric hospitalist. Figs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular emergency room drama on TV, maybe based in Pennsylvania, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids, and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. Now, with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year. Which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for this season. And so, Cribsiders listeners, if you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
I have a question on a practical standpoint. For me, you know, when I went through residency, these are not two procedures that I was trained on. You know, I can place center lines and art lines and all these other things, but I was not trained how to do subdermal implants or IUDs. Are these things that can be easily learned? And are there types of courses that someone like me who can, after the fact, now can learn how to do in my own primary care clinic?
Yeah. So not to date any of us, but part of the reason we didn't learn this is because, like, the guidelines when we were training did not say that these were kind of first line or contraceptive methods to be used by individuals that had never had a pregnancy before. And so some of the old knowledge around intrauterine devices was that we could not use them until you'd had a pregnancy in that uterus before. And that has changed recently. I'm using air quotes recently. In terms of the contraceptive arm implant, there is a way to train and learn how to place those. It's actually training provided by the company that creates this medication so that there is specific training and sign-off that's done in order to place it.
Very surgical in that manner. But I was going to say, let's start with the subdermal implant and let's kind of go through the same things we were talking about earlier. So pros and cons, you know, what are these patients going to gain and what are they going to be worried about?
Okay, so pro that I hear from patients is that, you know, it can lighten their period. They actually really like that they can feel it in their arm and that they can see it. But they do like the fact that it works for many years at a time and they don't have to think about it. Believe it or not, it works better than a vasectomy when you talk about effectiveness. And so it's incredibly, incredibly, like, you know, powerful when it comes to pregnancy prevention, if that's what your patient's primary value is. It's easy to place, it's easy to remove. And, you know, once you have it, you don't have to do anything afterwards.
So it sounds like we should do it. What are the downsides?
Some of the downsides include it can cause irregular bleeding. And that's something that I talk about with patients. So, you know, with the injectable contraception that we just finished talking about, oftentimes the more you take it, the better the irregular bleeding gets. And that's not always true with the subdermal implant. Sometimes the irregular bleeding gets better and sometimes it doesn't. And so for patients that we place these in, I tell them a third of patients have lighter periods, a third of patients have no change in their periods, and a third of patients have, you know, spotting or worsening periods. And I can't guarantee which group you're going to be in. What I can guarantee you is that I'm going to be the person to help you if those are side effects that happen that you don't like. And there's lots of things that we can do when your period has changes that you don't like to kind of get you through that if you're really committed to continuing to use this method. However, if you decide not to use this method anymore, we'll take it out.
Problem solved.
Yeah, no big deal. You do sometimes hear that these methods are really expensive and that, you know, well, if they're so expensive, they should leave them in or keep them in for X amount of time. And I really pause people when they assume that just because a method is expensive, we should coerce somebody into continuing to use it that does not want to use it. So when I meet a patient that has been told that they're not allowed to get a device out of their body until XYZ happens, that breaks my heart because we have just broken fundamental trust in a patient when we have tried to provide a birth control method, and we've probably lost their trust for many, many years to come in terms of their ability to believe us when we say something about birth control moving forward.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that I think about when I hear you talking about coercion is the IUD. I think for a lot of us, it was thinking about LARCs first, long-acting reversible contraception. And the IUDs are really a part of that conversation when it comes to reproductive coercion, but they can also be a really great option for our adolescents and our young adults too. And so I'm wondering how you counsel specifically around them.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a really great point, Crystal, because there has been a period in our medical field where LARCs first was really the message that was being transmitted. But when we looked at that, we were missing the mark in so many ways for patients. And we're still dealing with the side effects of that kind of approach to contraceptive counseling and contraceptive decision making. And so it's really important for us to know and listen to what patients are saying, because back to the very beginning of this episode, if we're not, then we are creating a situation where they cannot feel listened to. And to your point, we have data showing that people with black and brown skin report that happening more often to them than those without.
Perfect. And so when we have this health equity mindset, when we're thinking about how we meet that patient where they are, for one of the questions that I get is there like a lower age limit to using the IUD? Like, what are your thoughts about how and who is the appropriate candidate for receiving an IUD?
Yeah, I don't think there is an age limit, but obviously you will want to make sure your patient is making this decision on their own and is not feeling pressure or coercion from the other people in their life, and that, you know, the procedure is going to be something that they are comfortable with. There's been a lot of attention also on pain control during insertion for intrauterine devices in particular. And so making sure that you are prepared, especially with maybe some of the younger patients, to provide that pain control if that's something that might happen.
So some of us may not be fortunate to be able to have the skill set to place these IUDs. Who are the people that you're referring to in your community to help, you know, your patients who've decided, I want to proceed with an IUD? Who are you sending them to?
Yeah, that's a great point. And a point that we need to kind of make sure everybody hears on this podcast, that even if you're not able to provide the full gamut of birth control methods, making sure that you know who to refer to is really important. And making sure that you're referring to clinicians that you know provide really good patient-centered care and that are able to provide care, you know, preferably on the same day as an appointment rather than requiring multiple appointments after they've seen you. In a lot of medical systems that I work in as a general pediatrician, they can have up to 3 appointments before they have, you know, a long-acting reversible contraception method placed because of the systems that we've built and the barriers to accessing that care from the pediatric space. And so making sure you understand who your referral places are and how to expedite that for your patient is really important.
And I know for me as an adolescent medicine fellow, we have like a family planning clinic within our adolescent medicine space. Oftentimes there might be OBGYN. Some places have adolescent, so child and adolescent OBGYN that are also really great options. And then I also encourage folks to look out into their city. And so sometimes cities have dedicated sexual and reproductive health clinics that exist in the community that you can also refer patients to receive an IUD or the subdermal implant if that's not something that your clinic is available to offer.
Exactly.
And then just to kind of wrap up a little bit, again, trying to be the same approach for each one and not to exclude anyone. The pros and cons again. Can we just talk really fast? Maybe we'll separate this between the levonorgestrel intrauterine device and the copper intrauterine device. Just what are the pros and cons when you talk about this with your patients?
Yeah. The benefits of a hormonal IUD are similar, where you can have lighter periods or they could totally go away and they don't affect your ability to get pregnant in the future. And again, they can last anywhere from 3 to 12 years. And so you don't have to remember it every day. I do want to note that there is a non-hormonal IUD, which can be used if somebody's interested in a non-hormonal method or has contraindications to hormonal methods of birth control. It is a copper IUD and it works slightly differently, but with similar benefits.
All right. We've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about oral contraceptive pills that have estrogen-containing components. We've talked about patch. We've talked about vaginal rings. We've talked about pills that don't have estrogen-containing products. We've talked about injectable contraceptions. We've talked about subdermal implants. We've talked about IUDs. With all of that in mind, I actually want to just take us a little bit back to that first question that Crystal asked, because I think this is very important when we talk about the history, because now we've mentioned a little things like migraine with aura or blood clots or other stuff like that. So what actually do we need to get from that history when we're first doing this, now that we are actually talking about these medicines?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm assuming if you're there for like a physical, some of the past medical history has been covered. So you know that your patient doesn't have lupus or another rheumatological disease. You know your patient doesn't have a heart defect or something like that. And so I'm assuming that a lot of the other medical contraindications are things that are kind of known to you as the clinician of the patient because you've done a medical history. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Although I guess I don't really know why lupus and heart disease are a problem. So can you, I don't know. Is that actually part of the pieces?
So for a patient that has any complex medical diagnosis, and I'm just going to name a couple like sickle cell disease or lupus, you'll want to consult the medical eligibility criteria, which the CDC puts up and we'll put in the show notes. There's also an app that you can download for your phone so that it's easy for you to access wherever you are, just to make sure that you are counseling on methods that are not contraindicated based on that medical diagnosis. But a vast majority of young people do not have a contraindication to hormonal birth control. And the few things that I pay attention to are whether they have high blood pressure, whether they have migraines with aura, and whether they have or reported history of smoking.
So you'll take them on the word for it, not these adolescents who are secretly smoking like in the bathroom or something.
I mean, again, we get back to like trusting our patients and, you know, it's not a contraindication. It's just something that we talk about as like something that they need to think about increases their risk. And while it might not be a big deal when they're like 15, it might be a big deal when they're 30 and they're still smoking and they still want to use birth control. But yeah, smoking is like a whole other thing that we can talk about another podcast.
Which we have plenty of podcast episodes for folks to go back and reference on some great counseling that we can do around tobacco cessation and vaping.
Yeah.
But I think as a way to possibly land this hormonal contraception and non-hormonal contraception plane is to think about emergency contraception. So let's say that we're back with our patient and Chioma shares that they had unprotected sex 2 days ago. Are you thinking about emergency contraception? They're not currently using a method. Can you walk us through your process of thinking about it?
Yeah, I absolutely would offer and counsel on emergency contraception. So this is something that you can find out if your clinic has. My clinic, for example, has emergency contraception pills that we're able to give to the patient right there if they decide that they want to take a dose. There's three different types of emergency contraception, and two of them are pills. And actually, the hormonal and non-hormonal IUD that we talked about earlier can also be a form of emergency contraception. The trick is you need to have placement within 5 days of unprotected sex. And so the caveat is that most of us are in clinical settings and are not able to provide that. And so we'll talk about the two different pills. One is levonorgestrel, which is progestin only form of emergency contraception. That is the form of emergency contraception that you see on the shelf called the morning after pill, Plan B, Julie. There are lots of other names for it on the shelf. And that is the emergency contraception that works better the sooner you take it. And so that's why it's really helpful to have it in your clinic, right? So if a patient says that they want to take it, that you're able to give it to them right then and there rather than sending a prescription and hope that they get to a pharmacy to get it. The other form of emergency contraception is called olopristal acetate. That it works in a different mechanism. It's actually a progestin receptor inhibitor that is prescription only, and it is important to know because it works better if you are more than 3 days out from unprotected sex. So it works the same day one as it does day five. And so if somebody says, I had unprotected sex 5 days ago, your head should be going to Ella if you are really worried that they could become pregnant. So the other thing about Ella that's helpful to know is that it works better if your patient weighs over 200 pounds. That does not mean that your emergency contraception is not working well. It just loses some of its efficacy. So those are the two different forms, and I would definitely counsel and offer if your patient is interested in preventing pregnancy.
And you said they are over the counter?
So one of them, the first one, the levonorgestrel, is over the counter. I always prescribe it because it is not cheap over the counter. And then the olopristal acetate is only prescription only.
And then just to kind of complete this, because we did talk about these as backup, you know, contraception methods for if, you know, for example, you missed X number of days of your pill, whatever it might say in the sheet that we would hand out, depending on which one you took. You know, so we have that in our back pocket. We also talked about how the urine pregnancy test, sometimes we need that depending on number of days out and things like that. Because it's happened after 5 days and you're not really sure, can we talk a little bit about the sensitivity of a urine pregnancy test, for example, to find out, okay, when does that become positive for someone who might be pregnant? And so is there a time where you are negative on a pregnancy test but still could possibly be pregnant?
Yeah, so it really depends on when they had unprotected sex relative to when they're seeing you. So I usually tell patients that if you had unprotected sex, like less than 7 to 14 days from when I'm seeing you, the pregnancy test that we do today is not going to reflect a potential pregnancy that might have happened during that sexual encounter. And so if you do not get your period in 2 weeks from now, then I highly recommend you take a pregnancy test or you come back to our clinic so we can do a pregnancy test here.
And so a pregnancy test for everybody out there too also measures, you know, HCG, and you just have to build up enough for it to test positive. Awesome.
To be sensitive, yeah. But I do want to clarify, you don't need a urine pregnancy test before taking emergency contraception. Right. So it's safe to take over the counter. It's safe to take when you're pregnant. It's the same hormone your body makes when you're pregnant. And so that's why, you know, I prescribe it to everybody. I give refills to everybody. And I make sure that everybody knows about it, because you often hear about young people sharing the doses that they have with each other because it is so expensive and it is so hard to access. And so if you only give your patient one dose and they give it to a friend, then your patient also doesn't have anything to use. And you guys can cut this if you want. This makes some people uncomfortable, but for young people that are having infrequent sex, sometimes emergency contraception is their way of protecting themselves against pregnancy. And they don't want to take a method every day. They don't want to be on hormones every single day. And so emergency contraception doesn't always have to be a plan B. For some people, it can be a plan A, and that's okay.
And I actually think this ties in really well to the question I was going to ask about prescribing. So, for example, going to fill these medicines, prescribing these medicines, say their parents don't want to know about you having a 12, you know, refill for your Oprostol. Like, is there anything that you recommend doing, any tricks that you have? Or at the end of the day, look, you have to at least, you know, at least take care of yourself. So you have to step up somewhere as an adolescent if you don't want your parents to know.
Yeah. So the first thing is that if a patient expresses that confidentiality is of utmost importance to them, then I would encourage you to try to get them to a Title 10 clinic, because that provides federal protections to privacy for our patients in a way that is much more solid than any of the clinical systems that we work in. And we could put a link as to how to find a Title 10 clinic. That's another resource that you should have in your back pocket for any patient. However, for patients that are in my clinic, I talk about the things I have control over and the things I don't have control over. So some of the things I do not have control over is like an explanation of benefits going to your parent, or a pharmacy calling because you have a refill ready and the phone number on file is your parent's, because that's who's always been the pharmacy's phone number. And so encouraging them to think through all of those and to offer to facilitate a conversation when they are ready with their parents about the use of birth control and why, you know, you support them in making this really big decision. A lot of people use birth control for many other reasons other than pregnancy prevention. We use it for menstrual regulation. We use it for a lot of other reasons. And so it's not something that we should be afraid to share or to ignite stigma around, because it really needs to be something that's more normalized. And so I applaud families when they have open relationships with their young people, because honestly, having a trusted adult and a parent involved in this is like, it shows how protective an environment this young person is in making these decisions, and that there's somebody that's going to be there when they have a question or an uh-oh moment and they're not navigating this for themselves. And I wish I still had that person in adulthood. It's not just because they're minors. It's just really, really empowering and beautiful to see those relationships in our clinic. And so, you know, I think a lot of times people think of teenagers and they're like, I don't want to think about it, or like, this is making me icky and I don't want to kick the parents out of the room. And it doesn't have to be like that. And when you have that sense walking into the room, the teenagers feel it. And they are just as uncomfortable and don't want to be in that room either.
I think that's a fantastic place to summarize. Do you guys have any other questions, or should we kind of go to take home points?
I think we should take home points.
So the main points I hope everybody hears after listening to this podcast is, you know, person-centered care and listening to your patients is the most important part of any birth control counseling session. Making sure that you remember that there are lots of factors to birth control methods besides efficacy that you should be thinking about. Keeping systems and processes open so that your patient can always reach back out and communicate with you as to how that birth control method is going. And remembering that anybody can prescribe birth control, that birth control is relatively safe, and there are lots of resources that we're going to put in the show notes to help you provide birth control access for your patients. It's more important now than ever.
Anything else you want to plug before you say goodbye to our audience?
I guess the other thing that I would say is that, like, I really hate when people only talk about birth control with, like, their female presenting patients.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everyone needs to know.
Yeah. One of the things I push a lot of adolescent presenting males is, you know, what kind of birth control is your partner on? Have you talked about that? And the amount of kind of blank stares that they have back to me really is like a moment of like potential education and encouragement to have those conversations with their partner. And so I think we also do a disservice in medicine by only focusing these conversations on people that are pregnancy capable and not encouraging an open dialogue with everybody who potentially could be sexually active in terms of talking about birth control options.
Or even just how reproduction works.
Yeah. Like, I talk about emergency contraception with guys all the time because I'm like, I need somebody to know about emergency contraception when that uh-oh moment happens.
But it sounds like it's a good idea to prescribe, you know, Yulpristal or whatever the medicine that you're choosing to prescribe with very many refills to every single patient, regardless of with male, female, et cetera. Just prescribe it to everybody and then they can give it to anybody. Yeah. They can use it themselves. They can give it to friends. Just get that prescription out there for people.
And the reason why I prescribe it is it's expensive, but there are also barriers at pharmacies for access for young people in particular. And so with a prescription, those tend to go away. It is available over the counter, but I try to do that to also facilitate access for patients.
Nice.
Thank you guys so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on the show again.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website, thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Crystal Nwora, our wonderful social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X Blue Sky and Instagram. And I've been Sam Azer.
I've been Crystal K. Nwora.
And this has been Chris, the Chew Manchu. Thank you and good night. And for those who made it to the end of this very long episode, I have a short haiku for you. Safe space, private talk. Many options, informed choice. Teen health empowered. All right, see you guys. Bye.